Hey everybody, Marcus here. In this video, I would like to explore the idea of hypergamy. And though the concept of hypergamy has been covered by many MGTOW content producers in the past, development of this idea has all but stopped. And this I consider a tragedy. I mean, the current account of hypergamy I found in our community, well, they're coarse. And though this coarseness makes hypergamy easy to absorb, this coarseness does not allow us to account for a fundamental assumption made by MGTOW. In MGTOW, as far as hypergamy is concerned, it is assumed that all women possess this attribute. This, however, is an assumption, an assertion put forward with no definitive account justifying it. This is a big problem for MGTOW because until a sound argument can be put forward demonstrating that all women possess the attribute of hypergamy, hypergamy cannot be said to be part of the conjunctive set of attributes MGTOW claim true of all women. If we cannot add hypergamy to this conjunction, then it follows that women who are not hypergamous can exist. As argued in my Nawalt Part 2 video, such a conclusion would entail that all women do not possess the potentiality of hypergamy. If all women do not possess the potentiality of hypergamy, then hypergamy either does not exist or is a social construct. If hypergamy does not exist, well, then nothing can be said of the subject as knowledge of the non-existent is impossible. However, if hypergamy is a social construct, then it is not biological and therefore can be socialized out of women. Now, MGTOW make both the claims that hypergamy exists and that hypergamy is biological. If these claims are true, then it must be possible to prove that all women possess the potentiality for hypergamy, and therefore hypergamy can be added to the conjunctive chain of that which all women are like. Now, what is important to note is that if we can demonstrate that all women possess the potentiality of hypergamy, we, through metaphysical necessity, have proven that hypergamy ontologically obtains, namely, that hypergamy exists. Now, in order to understand how this works, we need to understand the concept of, well, metaphysical necessity. Now, this is a notion that was made prominent by Kripke in his work Naming and Necessity, published in 1980, although the idea itself is much older. It goes something like this. One property F necessitates another property G, just in case, necessarily, if F is instantiated, then G is instantiated. Equivalently, if F is instantiated, then G must be instantiated. Okay, what does this actually mean? Well, this means that there can be two things that always go together. For example, if I raise my hand, then I necessarily raise my fingers, because it is not possible to raise my hand without raising my fingers. Okay, that might not have been the best example as well. My fingers might have been chopped off. So let's use a better example. If something is red, then it necessarily is colored. If something has an area, then it necessarily has length and width. And finally, if something can be shown as a form, then it must necessarily exist. So, through metaphysical necessity, if we can prove that all women possess the potentiality for hypergamy, then we have shown a form. Therefore, hypergamy will necessarily exist, as it is not possible to participate in the non-existent. So, let's get started. Let us be rigorous from the start and not make the assumption that hypergamy exists, as we have yet to prove this. Instead, let us look at how it has been described and proceed from there. Hypergamy, in its basic formulation, has been defined as follows: women trading up to get a better deal. Now, this is not a controversial formulation, but neither is it particularly informative. I mean, at first glance, this definition looks true. However, this definition is also true of men. After all, who has not changed their mobile phone provider to get a cheaper service, or, you know, bought a new car in place of a car that required regular fixes? I mean, these examples and countless others fit our initial formulation. But here, it would seem we have hit on two more implicit assumptions. When we think of the term hypergamy, do we not implicitly assume that hypergamy is exclusively a female attribute? Well, indeed we assume this. Also, we implicitly assume that hypergamy speaks to the phenomenon of women trading in one man for another, and not a woman trading in one car for another. And do we not call the first case, namely trading in one man for another, as hypergamy, while we refer to the second case, namely trading in one car for another, as merely prudence? Well, this too is true. So it would seem that there are two categories of trading up that we can talk about. The first category of trading up we call prudence, while the second category we call hypergamy. And from our assumption that only women are hypergamous, it would follow that all trading up that men engage in is of a kind that falls into the category of prudence. Now, we have in no way proven that all trading up that men participate in falls into the category of prudence. So it would seem that it may be possible that men are also hypergamous. From this, it follows that we have four possibilities if hypergamy ontologically obtains. 1. Only women are hypergamous. 2. Only men are hypergamous. 3. Men and women are hypergamous. And 4. Neither men or women are hypergamous. Now, for the time being, I will put aside the question of who possesses the attribute of hypergamy. For simplicity, let us assume that if hypergamy ontologically obtains, then only women are hypergamous, as this is the formulation that we as MGTOW understand of hypergamy. Now, we will return to this assertion further on in our argument. Okay, so we have identified two categories of trading up, those of prudence and that of hypergamy. So let us explore the category of prudence first. Now, we have differentiated between prudence and hypergamy by saying that a hypergamous trade acts on men as the objects of trade, and a prudence trade acts on anything but a man. So it follows that hypergamy is a trade where the object of trade are people, while prudence is a trade where the objects of trade are not people. Now, let us look at how trading up in the category of prudence would look like. Well, if indeed one is trading up, then it must follow that the object being traded in is of inferior quality to that being traded for. After all, if both the object traded in and the object traded for were of equal quality, then we would not be trading up. It would also not be considered trading up if the object being traded in was superior in quality to the object traded for. However, as part of our formulation of hypergamy, we also have the concept of the better deal. Now, let us imagine that I have a cell phone plan from Verizon that costs me, say, $10 a month for 100 minutes of talk time. If AT&T was offering a plan for $20 for 200 minutes, and I traded my $10 plan for AT&T's $20 plan, it can indeed be said I traded up. However, it cannot be said that I got a better deal. I mean, in this example, I got the exact same deal from both carriers. So, I traded up the minutes, but the deal remained the same. However, if AT&T had a $10 plan for 200 minutes, and I switched my Verizon $10 for 100 minutes plan for the AT&T $10 for 200 minutes plan, then I would both be trading up and getting a better deal. So from this it follows that the sort of trade we are interested in has the quality that the benefit derived per unit of cost is higher than before. Now, this is very important for what I'm about to say next. If indeed a prudent trade can be understood as getting a better value per unit of cost, then it does not follow that the object being traded for necessarily needs to be of superior quality. I mean, this contradicts what I have previously said, that the object traded for must be of higher quality. Now, let me explain how this works. The $10 per 100-minute Verizon plan yields a cost-benefit value of $1 per 10 minutes. The AT&T $10 per 200 minutes plan yields a cost-benefit of $1 per 20 minutes. Now, earlier we said that we were trading up the 100 minutes for 200 minutes. Clearly, 200 minutes is twice as good as 100 minutes. But what if AT&T, in addition to their $10 for 200 minutes plan, also offered a $2 for 50 minutes plan? If we took the second plan, then we would be downgrading our minutes from 100 minutes to 50 minutes and downgrading our cost from $10 to $2. However, the cost benefit of the $2 for 50 minutes plan is $1 for 25 minutes, which is clearly higher than the $1 per 10 minutes cost benefit we currently have. So from this, it would follow that even though we would only get half the minutes, we would be getting a deal that is 2.5 times better. So in both cases, by switching from the $10 per 100 minutes plan to either the $10 per 200 minutes plan or the $2 for 50 minutes plan, we have gotten a better deal. Of the two new plans that we can switch to, it appears like the 50 minute plan is actually a better deal than the 200 minute plan. Now, let us continue our example of switching phone plans. When we switched from our $10 plan from Verizon to the $10 plan from AT&T, did we switch plans or carriers? Well, it could be said we did both. However, switching from Verizon to AT&T was coincidental. The benefit did not come from switching carriers, but from switching plans. AT&T, in this case, was not the object of our trade. The carrier was contingent. Had the better plan been offered by, say, Vodafone as opposed to AT&T, then we would still have switched plans, but ended up with Vodafone instead of AT&T. So in this way, we can say that there is an object of our trade and one or more contingent things that can be linked to the object of our trade. Okay, let us summarize the trades found in the prudence category. A trade can be seen as a better deal if the cost per unit of benefit is lower for the object traded for than the cost per unit of benefit for the object being traded in. In addition, there may be more than one contingent thing that is linked to the trade itself. In addition, we demonstrated that getting a better deal can actually take place when downgrading quality. Cool. Now that we have covered the category of prudence-based trades, let us explore hypergamy. Earlier, we had said that hypergamy is a trade that deals with people. This was said to differ from prudence-based trades in that prudence-based trades dealt with anything but people. Now, if it is the case that hypergamy deals with trading people, then it follows that the man himself is analogous to the cell phone plan. Earlier, we argued that there may be more than one thing contingent to the trade itself. So if the man is the cell phone plan, then it would follow that a man's resources and status would be the contingent things. Now, to clarify, in our cell phone plan example, we said that the trade was based on the plan and the carrier was contingent. So if the man in this case is the cell phone plan, then his resources and status are merely contingent and are not part of the decision-making process of trading in one man for another. After all, if the worth of the deal is vested in the man, then it matters not what contingent qualities come with the deal. Now, much like we did not concern ourselves whether the better cell phone plan came from Verizon, AT&T, or Vodafone, so too would the woman not concern herself how much money or status a man has, as the value of the deal would be in the man himself and not in the contingent qualities. From this, it follows that a penniless nobody can be the better deal compared to the millionaire celebrity. And from this, a woman trading in a millionaire celebrity for a penniless nobody could be observed as performing a hypergamous act. Now, it is not necessary for us to determine on what grounds any woman would gauge value in a man as a man. You know, we merely wish to demonstrate that if indeed hypergamy is based on trading in people, then it would be based on such qualities and not on contingent qualities. If what we have argued so far is true and women are hypergamous, then it follows that women would be trading in millionaire celebrities for penniless nobodies. We do not see women trading in millionaire celebrities for penniless nobodies. Therefore, either women are not hypergamous or hypergamy is not trading in people. But if trading in people is not hypergamous behavior, then what could it be? Well, perhaps we made a mistake in assuming that money and status were the contingent qualities instead of the deal itself. Maybe the man was not, in fact, the cell phone plan, but the carrier. And the wealth and status was the true cell phone plan. If this is true, then it follows that the man himself is the contingent quality, and the deal is his wealth and status. Now, if the wealth and status is the deal, and the man the contingent quality that comes with the deal, then there's no difference between prudent trades and hypergamous trades. Remember, earlier we argued that a hypergamous trade dealt with trading in people, whereas a prudent trade dealt with trading in with anything other than people. As wealth and status is anything but a person, there is no difference between a prudent trade and a hypergamous trade. Therefore, prudent trades and hypergamous trades are the same thing. So, does this mean that women are not hypergamous? Well, perhaps not. Let us explore this question from, well, another direction. It is said that men have been known, you know, to trade in women for a newer model. So perhaps it is men then who are hypergamous. Now, a man as a man can be separated from contingent qualities such as wealth and status. For example, one day a man is poor. The next day he wins the lottery. On the third day, he gambles it all away. Now, this man remained the same man across all 3 days. First he was poor, then wealthy, then poor again. The contingent quality of his bank account can easily be separated from the man himself. The content of his bank account can be taken from him by another man without destroying the money itself. The quality can be transferred or stolen without being destroyed. But what about the looks of a woman? Can a woman's looks be separated from her as a person? Can her looks be transferred or stolen without being destroyed? Well, surely not. So it follows that a woman's looks are not contingent. Her age is also not a contingent quality, nor is her fertility. But from this it follows that a man who trades up to a newer model is said to be trading in an older woman for a younger, prettier woman. I mean, if this is the case, then indeed the man is trading in people and not on contingent qualities as, well, youth and beauty have been argued not to be contingent. However, this means that a man indeed trades up in two ways. In the first way, he makes prudent trades that deal with anything except people, like when he trades in his car. And in the second case, where romantic relationships are concerned, he trades in people and not prudently. If he indeed trades up women the way described, then he would be making hypergamous trades, as hypergamy was defined as trading in people. So, what ended up happening? I mean, we initially set out to demonstrate that women trade up in two separate ways. And we set out to demonstrate, after all, that women trade up in a prudent manner as far as things are concerned, and that they trade up hypergamously as far as men are concerned. We also asserted that if men are not hypergamous, then all their trades would be prudent. But we found ourselves concluding the very opposite. We find that it is women who prudently trade both things, and men who, while men trade things prudently, they trade women hypergamously. However, let us explore the consequences of what has been shown. If it is true that men trade up women differently than women trade up men, then it follows that men and women trade up differently as far as trading up people is concerned. This means that two of our four original options are no longer the case. Our remaining two options are as follows then. Either men are hypergamous and women are not hypergamous, or men are hypergamous and women are not hypergamous. Now, if we accept the argument and conclude that we have sufficiently shown that men are hypergamous and women are not, and women and men trade up differently, then what do we call the way that women trade up? I mean, if we call the way men trade up as hypergamous when men trade up women explicitly, then what do we call the phenomenon of women considering a particular man contingent to the deal itself? Well, it would seem this phenomenon has no name. And surely we cannot also label it as hypergamy, since it has been shown that women trade up men contingently, while men trade up women explicitly. But maybe we got the names backwards. Maybe the way women trade up men contingently is indeed correctly labeled hypergamy, and it is men trading up women explicitly that has no name. To understand this, let us go back to our initial description of hypergamy. Hypergamy was posited as getting a better deal. Now, does a man really get a better deal by trading in an old woman for a young woman? Well, let us define our three actors in this exchange. One, we have the man. Two, we have his girlfriend. And three, we have his mistress. Now, let us assume a few things about our three actors. Let us assume that the man was 25 when he met his girlfriend, and that she happened to be 25 at that time. Now, let us imagine that the man and his girlfriend are now 50. This means that this man was with his girlfriend for 25 years. Now, let us imagine that the mistress is 30 years old. And finally, let us assume that the man from the age of 25 to the age of 50 always made the same salary and never changed his station in life. Now, the question is, if this 50-year-old man swaps his 50-year-old girlfriend for his 30-year-old mistress, is he getting a better deal? After all, his mistress is 20 years younger than his girlfriend. The answer to this question is no. The 50-year-old man is not only not getting a better deal, he is in fact getting a worse deal than what he got with his girlfriend. But surely this is nonsense. I mean, after all, clearly, a 30-year-old is much younger and prettier than a 50-year-old, and we said earlier that men find the value of the deal in youth and beauty. Well, yes, it is true that a 30-year-old is, younger and prettier than a 50-year-old. It is also true that men find worth in youth and beauty. But you see, the deal the man got with his girlfriend was when she was 25 and not 50. So the two deals that need to be compared are not between getting a 50-year-old and a 30-year-old, but between a 25-year-old and a 30-year-old. Earlier, we assumed this 50-year-old man had never increased his salary or net worth between the age of 25 and 50. As we have previously argued that women trade in men contingently, then it follows that the 25-year-old girlfriend saw her worth of youth and beauty at 25 to be commensurate with the wealth and status of the man at that time. As the man's wealth and status has not changed between 25 and 50, and now he can only get a 30-year-old instead of a 25-year-old, he's in fact getting a worse deal than what he got with his girlfriend. I mean, after all, a 25-year-old is surely younger and prettier than a 30-year-old. You see, in order for our man to get the same deal he got before, his mistress would have to have been 25 years old and equally as beautiful as his girlfriend at the same age. If he were to get a better deal, his mistress would need to have been younger than 25 and, well, more beautiful than his girlfriend at 25. Now, the counter-argument I can see leveled at this argument is that he is 50 and therefore he has lost value to women due to, well, looks or whatever. Now, this would have been a valid argument if we had not previously shown that the man in of himself is contingent. Remember? What difference does it make if the deal comes from Verizon, AT&T, or Vodafone? And in the same way, the value the woman sees is in his wealth and status. So what difference does it make if the man is 30, 40, or 50? After all, age is part of the man and therefore part of the contingency and not part of the value of the deal. So, if indeed our 50-year-old man is getting a worse deal, then it would follow that his benefit-to-cost ratio is lower. He is in fact paying more per unit of youth and beauty than his previous deal. If this is true, then it cannot be said that our 50-year-old man, in trading in his 50-year-old girlfriend for his 30-year-old mistress, is making a hypergamous move, as he is not getting a better deal. Okay, from this it can be concluded that indeed we did get it backwards when we said that, well, the way men trade up can be called hypergamous, as the benefit-to-cost ratio of the trade that a man makes will surely not yield a higher return. Now, my example with the 50-year-old was, well, clearly contrived, as it is unlikely that a man will not increase his wealth and status as he ages. So, if this argument holds true, then it follows that women trading men up contingently is indeed what we mean when we talk of hypergamy. This leaves the way men trade up women as a nameless entity. Now, though I do not plan to argue for this, I will simply call the way men trade women in, well, as vanity. So, what we have shown up to this point of the argument is as follows. We have demonstrated that women and men trade in their romantic partners differently. Namely, women trade in men contingently, and men trade in women explicitly. From this, we proceeded to demonstrate that the way women trade men in is aligned with our understanding of hypergamy, even though at first it seemed that it was really men who were hypergamous. But this argument is still not airtight in determining whether or not it is men or women who are exclusively hypergamous. After all, though grossly out of reach of most men, it is still possible that our 50-year-old could have gotten an 18-year-old and therefore satisfy the requirement of a better cost-benefit breakdown. Let us see if we can eliminate this uncertainty. The question we need to ask next is whether or not hypergamy is bounded or unbounded. If it is bounded, then it follows that hypergamy can be fully satisfied, and though a better cost-benefit breakdown is within reach, it will not be pursued. If it is unbounded, then it follows that there is never a point in which satisfaction can be reached. This would mean that the hypergamous instinct would continue to push the bear to take the better deal. Now, let us try and make this clear with some concrete examples. For example, thirst is bounded. This means that there's a certain amount of water that can be drunk to quench the thirst, and that the person would no longer continue to drink water after reaching the satisfaction, you know, even though more water was available. If thirst was unbounded, then the person would continue to drink until all the water was gone. Now, let us look at how men trade in women and see if the craving for youth and beauty is bounded or unbounded. Now, if the desire for youth and beauty was unbounded, then the rules would be simple. The younger, the better. However, this means that a 17-year-old would be better than an 18-year-old, and a 16-year-old better than a 17-year-old, and all the way down to infants. Now, clearly, men are not attracted to infants. In fact, outside of pedophiles, well, who are rare, men are not attracted to prepubescent girls. If this is the case, then there is a bound at which satisfaction for youth and beauty can be reached. In fact, girls younger than this threshold are not attractive. So it seems that if men are hypergamous, then this hypergamy is bounded. And you know, this makes sense from a biological perspective because a man cannot reproduce with a prepubescent woman. Though I will not formally argue the point here, I believe that women in their fertile years are usually capable at satisfying this desire for youth and beauty, you know, regardless of the specific age. Now, what about women? As we have previously argued that men are traded in contingently, it would seem that wealth, status, you know, and other external factors would be the realm in which hypergamy operates. As women trade up prudently, and it is always the case that a better cost-benefit ratio is preferable, it would follow that it would be prudent to take such a deal. As women are hedonistic by nature, they wish to maximize their pleasure and minimize their pain. From this it follows that where maximization of cost-benefit is possible, it will be taken. As such, if women are hypergamous, their hypergamy is unbounded. Women will, if within their reach, take the best deal that exists within reality. Now, if hypergamy is bounded, then, as we have stated before, it has a threshold that, when reached, will meet its own satisfaction. If this is the case, then how would hypergamy differ from merely a desire on the part of a man for a late teen pretty woman? Well, it would not differ. From this, it follows that hypergamy would not be trading up to get a better deal, but merely getting a specific deal. But in the beginning, we have stated that hypergamy was trading up to get a better deal. Therefore, we are in contradiction. From this, we must conclude that hypergamy cannot be bounded, as unbounded is the opposite of bounded, and we have demonstrated that hypergamy cannot be bounded, it follows that hypergamy is unbounded. If hypergamy is unbounded, then men cannot be hypergamous. It also follows that women are hypergamous. If men are not hypergamous and women are hypergamous, then it follows, well, necessarily, that women are exclusively hypergamous and hypergamy is an exclusively female trait. Now, though we have proven that it is women who are exclusively hypergamous, we still need to demonstrate that all women are hypergamous. Now, at this point, I think we can give a much better definition of hypergamy than, well, what we started with. From what has been argued, hypergamy is the unbounded potentiality for contingently trading in men to maximize the cost-benefit ratio. Now, this is a much more robust definition of hypergamy than what we started with. All right. Women are hedonistic by nature. Therefore, women wish to minimize pain and maximize pleasure. Now, can it not be said that benefit is pleasurable while cost is painful? Well, yes, both of these things can indeed be said. Therefore, women want to maximize benefit and minimize cost. Now, are there things that cause pleasure? Well, surely there are. Are there also things that cause pain? Well, this too is true. What about things that cause both pleasure and pain? Well, this too is true, as we can clearly see that drinking alcohol brings with it certain amounts of pleasure, you know, followed by a certain amount of pain through a hangover. Are there also things that cause neither pleasure or pain? Perhaps. You know, for the sake of the argument, let us posit that they do exist. Now, these four combinations are the only possible combinations. And of these four combinations, of which type would a relationship with a man fall into? Well, surely men are capable of causing pleasure as well as causing pain to women. If this is the case, then a woman who desires a relationship with a man will look to find a man that maximizes pleasure with the minimum amount of pain. Now, this man will provide a ratio of pain to pleasure. As we have argued earlier that cost and pain are equivalent while benefit and pleasure are equivalent, then we can say that the pleasure-to-pain ratio from a relationship with a man is synonymous with the cost-benefit ratio. As women are hedonistic by nature, it follows a woman will maximize the cost-benefit ratio when choosing a man. As hedonism necessarily maximizes pleasure and minimizes pain, it follows that hedonism is unbounded. For if it were bounded, then it would not be about maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain, but would be about finding a specific cost-to-benefit ratio, which we have already argued would be mere desire. So now we have women boundlessly maximizing the cost-benefit ratio of relationships with men. Now, when we say that women are hedonistic by nature, well, what do we mean? What do we mean when we say nature? Do we not mean biology? Well, surely we do. So if women are hedonistic by nature, then we are saying that women are hedonistic through biology. If this is the case, then women possess potentiality for hedonism. Now, if this is true, and we have shown that hedonism leads to the unbounded maximization of the cost-benefit ratio of relationships with men, then we can conclude that women possess the potentiality for the unbounded maximization of the cost-benefit ratio of relationships with men. Also, as we have previously demonstrated through an inductive argument that women trade up men contingently, then once again we arrive at our definition of hypergamy, the unbounded potentiality for contingently trading in men to maximize the cost-benefit ratio. So, we can see that hypergamy is really a consequence of hedonism. Since we have also asserted that women are hedonistic biologically, then it follows that hypergamy did not come about as a social construct. If hedonism in women is biological, then it also follows that it evolved. If it evolved, then it evolved in all women. To deny this claim is to assert that women exist in different states of evolution. So, if hedonism evolved, and all women evolved at the same level, and hypergamy is a consequence of hedonism, then it necessarily follows that all women are hypergamous. Now, as we have managed to demonstrate that all women participate in the form of hypergamy, through metaphysical necessity it follows that hypergamy exists. From this argument, then, MGTOW are justified in adding hypergamy into the conjunctive chain of that which all women are like. Now, The argument I have gone through here is, well, quite long and complicated, and it is possible that I may have made mistakes somewhere in my reasoning. However, the method I have used in this argument has, if nothing else, helped us yield a much more nuanced definition of hypergamy. As I progress through my series of videos on hypergamy, I will attempt to further develop this concept and work on evaluating consequences that stem from our new definition. If our new definition of hypergamy can be put up against the Alancus and survive, we can rest assured we have a solid definition. If it cannot, then we will need to work harder in improving our understanding of hypergamy. Thanks for listening. Go team.